Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Earlier this month, a report commissioned by none other than the British Foreign Secretary, at least for the next couple of hours, Jeremy Hunt, accepted evidence that Christians constitute by far the most widely persecuted religion. The review makes recommendations for how the UK Foreign Office can better address the issue, including calling for the United Nations to pass a resolution to allow UN observers to monitor necessary security measures to protect Christians and other persecuted minorities. On the line to tell us more, we have John Newton, Press Officer with Aid to the Church in Need. You're very welcome back to the show, John.
A very good morning to you.
First of all, John, can you tell us what this report is and what it found?
Well, absolutely. The Anglican Bishop of Truro was asked, as you say, by Jeremy Hunt to do a review of the SCO's practices to see how they're actually dealing with the whole issue of Christian persecution and to look at specific instances of Christian persecution in specific countries and to see what the SCO has done, how it's responded, what it could have done differently, what it could have done better, and to produce a whole draft of recommendations as to how the SCO can take forward its responsibilities in that area. And what it found really was that the SCO hasn't been on the ball in terms of freedom of religion or belief issues when it comes to Christians. It found that there was more that could be done, and it made three tranches, if you like, of recommendations. One, to try and position Britain as a leader in terms of issues regarding freedom of religion or belief. Secondly, to make sure that all those involved in international affairs are up to speed on these sorts of issues, to make sure they've got the right sort of education in that area, to make sure they're up to speed on the latest things. And secondly, was a whole draft of specific individual recommendations, for I think some of the most interesting things were to be found, where they really said, look, chaps, you know, you could be doing better in these areas, and these are some specifics we really think you should be focusing on.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible to think that, you know, such an obvious thing, where you have a country that is really worked very hard in terms of making sure that there's a kind of a freedom of approach in terms of various religions, that what has been the mainstay, the principal religion of the country, they're not watching out for it, like a kind of an accidental blindness, or is it something else, do you think?
Well, you often get Christian commentators over in the UK saying that one of the big problems is that we've traditionally been a Christian country, and there's been a bit of a kickback against that.
Sure.
There's a sense that we put too much emphasis on Christianity, and therefore possibly that there is a reaction against that, and suddenly Christians are not being allowed to have a voice in the public sphere. There's been high-profile cases about people not being allowed to wear crosses and so on and so forth. And there is that sense that possibly that the pendulum is swinging away
right
from the historic cultural sense of Britain as a Christian country. And so the whole question is, you know, has that sort of seeped into broader attitudes? Have some of those attitudes affected the way the FCO is working? It's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to it. But at the end of the day, what the report's saying is, whatever the reason is, yes, we are seeing certain things being done in the FCO, which could be being done better with regards to tackling the issue of Christian persecution and indeed discrimination in many countries.
I remember when I came on this show and about 8 years ago, when I was hit with that statistic that actually the most discriminated against denomination in the world in terms of deaths, in terms of, and there's never been so many kind of Christian deaths and martyrings in the history of the church as there is now, which was like absolutely amazing for me. I'd never come across that as a statistic before. But the report made some very specific recommendations. Can you talk about these?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the very specific things that it tries to champion, and which I'm particularly delighted that it's taken up, is the whole responsibility in the Middle East and North Africa region, where it's instructed the FCO to really push the UN to ensure that there is equal representation for those who are suffering, and particularly to take forward the whole issue of sex crimes against Christian and Yazidi women. Because, of course, when Daesh or ISIS took over huge swathes of Iraq and Syria, a number of women from minority groups were pushed into sexual slavery. They suffered absolutely horrendous conditions and horrendous treatments. And the world has to some degree heard about the Yazidi women because it was such a large number. But in many cases, they're completely unaware that a number of Christian women were also put into those circumstances. And anyway, I do think there is a sense that the UK government has dragged its feet in pushing those sorts of issues forwards, in ensuring justice for those minorities that, that were affected. There's been a lot of talk in Parliament, in both chambers of the House, both the Lords and the Commons, about the need to do more in Iraq, the need to do more in Syria, the need to recognise the genocide, the need to push forward the problems being faced by the survivors of that genocide. But when you look at what's being done, yes, they have made some headway, but considering the enormity of the crimes, it really is a drop in the ocean. And this is really saying, no, look, the Christians have had it in the neck, some other minority groups alongside the Christians have had it in the neck, we really, in justice for them, have to do something about it. And those two specific recommendations about focusing on that region are two which particularly encouraged me.
John, I noticed that there's one of the recommendations is to identify a label for Christian persecution. That's an interesting way that it's phrased, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And I think it was the Coptic Orthodox Archbishop Angelos who first suggested that what was needed was a label for this phenomena. You know, if people commit hate crimes against Muslims, if there's negativity towards Muslims, you know, Islamophobia is a word that's on the tip of people's tongue. It's
exactly
a term that we can use to describe it. But as he pointed out in an article quite some time ago now, that there is no equivalent phrase for Christian discrimination and persecution.
Very good.
And the whole question he raised, I think it was on Radio perhaps, on Radio 4, was whether the lack of this name, the lack of this label, means that we're not as quick to identify problems against Christians.
Yeah.
And it's an idea that's been batted around and kicked around quite a bit since then. But know that the report's picked this up and it's run with it. I'm not quite sure what they're going to come up with. I believe I heard that Jeremy Hunt had suggested that Christianophobia,
okay,
or Christophobia,
yeah,
was possibly a label to,
okay,
to go with. I know some Christians don't like that, some Christians do. But no, that will be interesting to see what develops in that instance.
Yeah, so why would you think this particular report is important? What's the significance specifically of it?
I think the significance is that in many cases people are unaware of what's going on in a number of countries, and in a number of other countries where people are aware of what's going on, there has been a lacuna or a shortfall in terms of what the response of the West has been. The report, really the meat of it, I'd say, is the case studies, you know, looking at the individual countries, looking at the individual incidences and saying, are these ones where the West has done something? If they're not, why didn't they do something? And if they did do something, what did they do? And why does it seem that in many cases that response wasn't really adequate? I mean, what was quite interesting in the research, certainly for some of the African countries, is that the US has a track record of making representation and defending religious minorities, including Christians, when they suffer problems. But we haven't seen similar sorts of interventions from the UK government. And so why is it? I mean, yes, okay, the US is a great global power, but you'd have thought that a country like the UK would be taking, as you said at the beginning, historically it's a Christian country, you'd have thought that they might have felt that there was an obligation to be helping, you know, Christian minorities when they were being persecuted.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier on the pendulum swing away from kind of Christian values, and I think that's probably fair to say same thing's happening in Ireland here. But I wonder too, is there a feeling that it might seem like preferential treatment, you know? The Christian West, inverted commas, coming in and, you know, arbitrating on behalf of these people or something like that?
Well, I have actually heard that from specialists in international development, that, you know, if you, I mean, one of the big frustrations we've had going back to Iraq is the fact that a lot of the aid that's been pumped in after the fall of Daesh, after the fall of ISIS, has not reached the Christians, it's not reached the Yazidis, it's not reached the Mandeans, it hasn't gone to the minorities at all. And the sorts of rhetoric that you get from people involved is, oh, well, if we gave it to the Christians, you know, it would be seen as favoritism, it would make them a target, people would attack them. And you think, well, that's nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, the Hungarian government gave a huge grant to help the Christians. You know, no one's attacked them because of that grant. And interesting, one of the report's recommendations, again, is that the whole question of adverse distinction, that you shouldn't make an adverse distinction between different groups, shouldn't be used as a cover not to help minorities. And this is something that comes up very much in the search on Iraq, a point that's made by Lord Alton in the House of Lords, which is quoted. He said, a policy of religion-blind aid has meant that the UK is unwilling to rebuild a Christian town or a Yazidi village, unable to grasp that the Nineveh Plains were always a patchwork of settlements belonging to different religious groups who lived in harmony with their near neighbours of another creed. And that's also echoed by Stephen Rasher, who is the legal counsel for the Chaldean Archdiocese of Erbil, who again is quoted in the report in one of the case studies, where a Christian school was allegedly repaired and all they did was put a coat of paint on the front, and they were outraged. Yes. And they took this up with the UN. But he, one of the points he made when speaking again to the United States aid people, he said, what often happens is a policy which is designed to stop unfair discrimination, you know, favouring one group over the other,
sure,
is being used not to give aid to minorities that have suffered from genocide. And that's got to be wrong.
Yeah.
And the fact that this is one of the issues that this report really calls out and asks the UK government to address, hopefully we'll see that being addressed across the West, because I think that is a problem that really is affecting the whole of the West in its view of aid. We're not helping minorities because we're afraid it's discrimination. But if we don't help those minorities, if we don't help the Christians, the Yazidis, the Mandeans, they may not be there in Iraq in 10 years.
Indeed. I'm wondering, given the parliamentary arithmetic, as they say, and the fact that everything may be about to change in the next couple of hours anyway, do you think this will lead to action, that this particular report will lead to action by the UK government, whether it's, Jeremy or somebody else?
Well, of course, Jeremy Hunt, this is very much his baby. This is his project, and he's basically committed to pushing this to the absolute max. So if we see Jeremy Hunt as the new Prime Minister, then absolutely no doubt. Boris Johnson has also made noises that he would be very committed to seeing the recommendations implemented as well.
Okay.
So I think whoever gets in, there will, broadly speaking, be support for it. I think, you know, we'll have to wait and see exactly how much Mr. Johnson will be backing this report if he gets in, but certainly he's made noises that he will be supporting its recommendations. So hopefully, whoever ends up as Prime Minister,
sure,
of
indeed,
the United Kingdom,
yeah,
we will see this taken very seriously.
Absolutely. John Newton, Press Officer and Aide to the Church in Need, thank you so much for talking to us this morning.
A pleasure.
Now, we have a great giveaway on the show this morning, a family pass to Odeon Cinemas. And in studio to tell us more, we have Victoria Johnston. You are very welcome back to the show, Victoria.
Thanks, Ronan.
I don't know why I'm welcoming you back to the show. You work on us. First of all, Victoria, tell us a bit more about the giveaway you have for us this morning.
Yeah, so we've a family pass to Odeon Cinemas. It's a family pass that's two adults and two children.
Brilliant.
And Odeon Cinemas are nationwide. So it's a great giveaway. They've cinemas in Dublin, Cavan, Limerick, Naas, Newbridge, Portlaoise, Waterford. So
great.
They're all over.
Super. Super. And have you been to any of the Odeon Cinemas yourself?
I've been to the Waterford Cinema, which is actually huge.
It's
a great cinema. And
yeah,
I was at Stillorgan over the weekend to see The Lion King.
Tell us about that.
It was great. Like, it's received mixed reviews, but personally, for a remake of Disney, really, really genuinely enjoyed it.
I'm so pleased to hear that. It's been getting some really horrible reviews, and yet you know that sometimes there's certain things that reviewers don't like, but audiences just love.
Yeah, and I've seen Dumbo,
The
Beauty and the Beast, all those remakes.
Them.
Yeah.
And, well, you're a fan.
I am, yeah. And but actually, The Lion King, I felt, was one of the definitely the better remake.
Wow.
Which was encouraging, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, it's, you know, they now have all the animatronic and the CGI and all that kind of really down. So, you know, mouths moving and all that kind of stuff. I saw a couple of clips. It looked very funny and you know, the lighting was beautiful. And,
yeah, the opening scene was actually spectacular. So that's the Circle of Life song. But I actually nearly felt I was watching a David Attenborough documentary.
Wow.
It was that quality.
Wow.
And you nearly forgot that it was an element of animation in it, which was really cool.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And it also changes the energy of the movie, because, you know, if you think about it, you know, a lot of those kind of 1990s, noughties, early noughties animation are kind of musicals aren't they? Musicals with animation.
Yeah.
And you get that feeling that that's what you're watching, whereas this, it changes the energy of it. It changes the feel. So that's really good. And did you find yourself, I mean, you know the story back to front, I'm sure, and we were just discussing, by the way, I did have a look at it. They did use the characters from Hamlet, but obviously the outcome is different.
Wow.
So that's where the...
I learned something new. Yeah.
So that's The Lion King for you. So listen, so recommend.
Absolutely. Wow. And it's such great songs anyway.
And they reuse the songs, do they?
Most of them are reused. They're obviously different arrangements.
Sure.
But I thought they did it very well. I think they might have left out a few songs and introduced one or two new songs.
Ones. Yeah,
Elton
cool.
John was back in writing.
Was he?
Yeah. Oh, and Beyonce, of course, is the voice of Nala. So she sang one song, of course, which wasn't in the original.
Yeah. She'd have to.
Yeah.
Be rude not to ask her.
But they're just great characters like Timon and Pumbaa. Hakuna Matata.
Superb, yeah.
Yeah.
Superb. And it's just, and again, you know, Tim Rice, Elton John, fantastic. And, you know, and I remember even at the time when Tim Rice and Elton John were getting together, I was going, ooh, I wonder how that's going to go. Because Tim Rice was obviously Andrew Lloyd Webber and those, and I loved actually the first two things they did together. I wasn't such a fan of Evita, but to me, Jesus Christ Superstar and Joseph, the two biblical type ones, were great. Songs were great. The vibe, the lyrics were brilliant. And I thought, I always liked Tim Rice, but I was thinking, how is that going to go with Elton John? But actually, it was magnificent. The songs in, like, in fact, you could nearly say the last decent thing that Elton John did was The Lion King.
Okay.
And I'd be a fan, you know, I'm a massive fan of Elton John, but in terms of that. So, I don't want to just like dwell just on The Lion King because we're talking about cinemas throughout the country. Other things going on, other films?
Yeah, Odeon Cinemas, they have Toy Story 4 in cinemas at the
moment.
Which,
can I say, is brilliant. Have you seen
it? I actually haven't seen it yet.
Oh, do you know what? This is me. I went absolutely holding my breath thinking, Toy Story 4, are you serious? Like Police Academy 11. It's like this, I do not like them. And I thought, my goodness, I was nervous going to Toy Story 2 and it was brilliant. I was nervous going to Toy Story 3 and it was brilliant. And I thought, there's no way they're going to be able to do four movies in a row that are going to work. And it's brilliant.
Wow, because there has been such a hype because it's been years since they've released the third one.
Well, it was so amazing. I'm there with my 17, almost 18-year-old son and daughter who is 14, almost 15, thinking, how's this going to go? And yet thinking, you know, myself and my wife went to see Toy Story before they were born.
Wow.
that's how long it's been since these have taken. And it's just, you know what? It's one of those films.
I think that all generations love.
I mean, it was a no-brainer. It was terrific. And you know, that moment when you have that kind of really emotional thing at the end, and Disney, sometimes I feel like I'm being manipulated, and I'm not going to cry now. This is just ridiculous. This was very, there was a real moment, a couple of real moments. It really, really marked everything. I couldn't say enough good things about
brilliant.
It.
Brilliant. Oh, I'll have to put that on the list, as well as Aladdin.
I mean, you were talking about remakes.
Yeah, that's in cinema as well.
Have you seen it?
I haven't.
Now that's one I'm keen to see. Does it work? Because there's an iconic first movie, right?
Yeah. So Aladdin is on my list. Toy Story 4 is on my list. And then when I saw The Lion King, they were advertising that Frozen 2 is coming to cinema at Christmas.
Yes.
And the new Star Wars film.
Okay.
So there's loads of family films coming out for the rest of the year. And then over the summer, I think The Secret Life of Pets 2.
Oh, right. Yeah,
but that's always going to be good fun.
Brilliant.
So so they've lots going on, and they've actually great deals because, you know, going to the cinema can be expensive by the time you bring the kids, the popcorn, but they've really good summer deals on, and you can sign up for their premiere package, which gives you even more discounts.
Now, surrogacy stories used to be the stuff of tabloids who reported on bizarre situations in far-off countries arising from arrangements that we wouldn't ever dream of permitting here in Ireland. Well, that looks set the change as a committee established to consider measures to regulate assisted human reproduction in Ireland seems set on a trajectory which will allow a more permissive regime than our European neighbours and could even make us a destination for surrogacy tourism. In her column in Saturday's Irish Times, Breda O'Brien proposes that we give more attention to the child's perspective in the surrogacy debate, and she's on the line to tell us more. You are very welcome to the show, Breda. How are you?
Thanks very much. I'm very well, Ronan. Thank you.
So first of all, Breda, the idea of surrogacy would be somewhat disturbing for many Irish people. Would the consensus not be just to ban it rather than regulate it?
Well, I would have thought that that would have been the consensus, because it's certainly the consensus right across Europe. If you think about countries like France, like Spain, France, Italy, Germany, Sweden were the latest ones, I think, to ban it in 2016. What they proudly called their first feminist government banned surrogacy completely. But what's disturbing about this committee report that has just come out is that they're proposing that the legislation actually look at allowing what's called traditional surrogacy. And to you and me, that's a woman conceiving her own baby, using her own eggs, carrying her own child, and then giving it away to commissioning adults at the end of it.
Yeah.
And this is so far out of the norm that I was looking at a huge fertility clinic in Ukraine last night, and I came across this on their website. And they said, and this now is a fertility clinic that actually does commercial surrogacy, and they said, in most countries of the world, including Ukraine, this type of surrogacy, that is, a woman carrying her own baby and giving it away, is strictly forbidden and is considered as child trade. And the committee was seriously suggesting that this be considered in Ireland, and it's so far out of step with what they're doing elsewhere in Europe that I actually was quite stunned.
Absolutely. It's like we're losing our moorings altogether, you know. it's weird, though, because, you know, when you think about it, when you balance that against the almost hysterical reaction when people are talking about finding birth parents and, you know, trying to get people back with people, you know, and the rightful, in fact, reaction when people are taken away from their birth parents and then trying to re-find them in middle age and later in life. And there's such an enthusiasm for that, that this seems to be kind of almost counterintuitive in some way.
It's completely counterintuitive. Like, if you look at, you know, the controversy there was about illegal adoption, or at least unregulated adoption, in the 1950s, when American servicemen would literally come here, pick up a baby, and bring it home to their wives. And at the time, if you look at the documentation around it, the time there was no concern about the welfare of the child. It was considered, you know, well, this is a great opportunity for a poor Irish child. They'll be brought up in the best, much better circumstances and so on. But it's only when the children became adults that people actually began to realize what was going on. Because I think everyone can relate to the thing of, it's only when you become a parent yourself, quite often, that you get a completely different perspective on these things.
Of course.
So all those children are, you know, saying, I was deprived, my identity was stolen away from me. Not all of them, but a significant minority of them would be doing that. But we don't seem to learn.
Yeah. Can I just ask you, Breda, what do we know about the committee itself, this Joint Committee on Health? Like, what is it? Who are they?
Well, basically, they're representatives, are elected representatives or senators and so on. And so they're what they sound like, a committee of the joint, the two houses. But even more interesting, I think, is the witnesses that they heard, because they heard, I think, 18 people, and an awful lot of them were people involved in the fertility industry. They were either running clinics or they were involved in providing fertility treatment to people, or they were academics. But there were only two voices out of 18 that actually were representing the voices of donor-conceived people, because conception through bulk sperm is around for an awful long time, much longer than surrogacy. And these people were very adamantly saying, there are huge issues here. But I didn't really see their concerns reflected in the report. What I saw reflected in the report, in the recommendations, there's lots of phrases like, this should be left to the clinician's discretion. In other words, it should be a discussion between the clinician and the client. So it seemed to be very much taking the industry's viewpoint on this, rather than people, one of whom Joanna Rose is actually donor conceived herself, it didn't seem to be really taking into account. And I wonder, Ronan, is that because when you see the coverage of this in the media most of the time, it's all about, you know, a loving couple and a beautiful baby. Nobody kind of thinks down the line to this baby, you know, saying, you know, why do I have, you know, why do I have a certain colour eyes and nobody in my family has this colour eyes?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, you know, I was only watching a rerun of on the late night TV of Philomena the other night, and I was just thinking about the way the heart of that story is, you know, obviously it's about her going to find this guy, but actually the heart of the story is this guy finds himself in America and realises that he is Irish, and really, and actually has himself, even when he dies, buries himself in Ireland because he's such a call back to Ireland, and she never gets to see him and she never talks to him and all that. But there is that feeling like we are kind of denying that very powerful thing within the child to go, actually, I am other, I am from somewhere else. And
absolutely. And we're all like, if you look at the popularity of the programs like Who Do You Think You Are, or, you know, genealogical research, or people tracing their roots, or all of that, it's very deep in human beings. We're not just kind of children of the moment, or people of the moment. We have a huge sense of a need to belong. And there's a really amazing photo essay in the New York Times at the moment with this young man who went in search of his 32 half siblings.
Gosh.
Now, this is another issue other than surrogacy. Yeah. This has now got to do with using both sperm and eggs.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinary. And you're looking at the resemblances between these people who have been reared in every part of the, you know, the United States. And he talks about the hair going back up on the back of his neck when somebody he's never met before actually has his own laugh. He hears his laugh coming from somebody else.
That must be weird.
And it's a very restrained thing. But I think the pictures speak for themselves. They're all young people. I think the youngest is probably 8 or 9, and then they go up, I think, to about 30. But imagine having 32 half-siblings out there.
Absolutely. I mean, and you know, like, as you know, I've got 2 foreign adopted children in my in my family, and I'd be very, very aware that feeling of, you know, not that they're particularly interested at this point, but that at some stage it will certainly come to them that they want to know something about where they're from and what they're of, you know. But can I just ask you, you know, what is known about the impact of donor conception and surrogacy on the child that is born? Has there been any studies done on this or anything?
Well, there
have
been studies, but the difficulty with them is the you know, the best known ones are by a woman called Susan Gollenbach, and as far as I know, they only go up as far as when the child is 14, and they tend to be, you know, interviewing the families and the teachers and, you know, and so on, who are not necessarily going to be always the best place to see what's going on internally in children.
They're not talking to the children themselves.
But could I go back just to make a quick point relation to adoption? Adoption's a very different thing in that you have a child in need of a family, and it's all about finding a family for the child.
Yeah.
Do you know? And you will know yourself that you cannot go through adoption without doing home studies.
It's enormous.
You know, it's a very rigorous process. Whereas there's one of the recommendations of this committee is that there was supposed to be mandatory counselling for everybody involved in any aspect of, you know, assisted reproduction. And they're sort of saying, oh, it's not really necessary. And this to me is incredibly short-sighted, because counselling is a minimum. You know?
Very basic, yeah, exactly.
Very basic. And you see, we've learned from people who are adopted. Now, an awful lot of people are adopted. They're absolutely thrilled. They don't feel any need to go in search of their, you know, their birth parents or those. But a significant minority do feel that they need to do that. And we listened to the significant minority in
Indeed.
That case, and we changed our practice.
Yeah.
Don't know.
That's a very good point. So we listen to the significant minority, because if there's a problem, it's a problem. It doesn't have to be affecting the majority of people.
Exactly.
If there's a significant minority, and we go, okay, we change practice. Whereas in this situation, are we just everybody just working on hunches at the moment?
Everyone, I think, is just working on a very natural and understandable sympathy that I share myself.
Yeah.
For people who cannot have children of their own.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, we all know what that's like, you know, the sort of the tugging that there is.
Absolutely.
But sometimes that natural sympathy blinds us. We don't have the same level of natural sympathy maybe for the children who are separated from their genetic links, you know, that are brought up, you know, perhaps in a different culture, a different country, no idea who their birth parents are. And, you know, it, and also the legislation is very, very minimalist. You're allowed, you, it has to be put, if you are conceived through both sperm or eggs or surrogacy, you, it has to be put on your birth cert. And the committee actually raised questions about that, sort of saying, well, is that, you know, necessarily a good idea? Is that, you know, interfering in a family's right to privacy?
Yeah.
But, like, that's... The keeping secrets within a family is a never a good idea, and it's a pretty massive secret if your dad is not your dad,
yeah,
biologically speaking. He might be your dad, and you might adore him, and you might not want to swap him for anybody because he raised you, but you should know that he's not biologically.
Absolutely, and you know, the kind of the transparency is that word, isn't it? And the more transparent and okay that we can be about these things. You hide something, then it becomes a thing of shame, and before you know it, you're hiding lots of other things too.
Yeah.
So, can I just ask you? I mean, I didn't mention this at the top, and I don't know whether I was overstating it, but is it conceivable that we could become a surrogacy destination?
That's an interesting one. I'm not so sure that we could become a surrogacy destination because there won't be that many people who want to do it for non-commercial reasons.
Okay.
But still, there's an interesting thing about the non-commercial. They have non-commercial surrogacy in the UK for quite a while. And the going rate, if you'll pardon me using that expression, is £15,000 for somebody who's going to carry a child. Now, that's not an insignificant amount of money. Is that about 18 grand in euro?
Yeah.
So the non-commercial doesn't mean no money at all. And to me, if somebody wanted to donate 18 grand to me in the morning, I'd
You'd be happy
very,
enough.
Very happy.
Exactly.
So... I'm not so sure about the issue that maybe is an issue that hasn't been highlighted is that the committee also kind of wanted to facilitate people who go abroad for commercial surrogacy in getting parentage established when they come back here. Now, it actually acts as a deterrent to people to doing that, you know, it is difficult to get parentage established if you go abroad and use a commercial surrogate and bring the baby back. I think if it's made easier, you will get more people going abroad. And as you probably know, after things like the baby Gammy case in Thailand, you remember there was a little twins were conceived and the baby with Down syndrome was left behind, baby Gammy. And then it emerged that the couple that had commissioned these children, that the father was on the sex offenders register.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that case.
I do, 2014.
So Thailand closed down foreign surrogacy. India has closed down foreign surrogacy. So because of the abuses. But we're saying, you know, it's kind of almost like a wink and a nod, almost like, you know, well, if you want to chance doing this, we'll kind of look favorably. And I do understand, I don't want any babies being stateless or being without an identity, but I think it's a dangerous, slippery slope kind of route.
I hear you. Like, if I'm hearing you right, what we're saying is that because we're not really exploring in proper detail the full issues here, that we're in danger of creating a kind of an unboundaried type of surrogacy. Not that, you know, whether you agree with it or not, that it's the kind of thing that actually could create a bit of mayhem in people's lives in time to come.
And you see, because this has been around in other countries for longer, you know, that it really wasn't something that Irish families contemplated very much until about the last, I think, 15 years. And even then it was a minority. But we've seen every possible disaster play out in other countries, including that case in the States recently where an Asian woman had thought she was carrying her two genetically, you know, her own genetic female babies. And when she gave birth, there were two non-genetically related to her or to each other baby boys that she had to relinquish to their biological parents, and she has no idea what happened to her own embryos. And that case is ongoing at the moment. And people say, oh, regulation. If it's properly regulated, that won't happen. But that's, you know...
Mistakes happen, yeah.
Things happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's and they have happened. And, excuse me, you can, I mean, any scenario that you think could be a disaster, including half siblings marrying each other, has actually already happened.
Yeah.
And that's why Germany, France, Sweden, you know, Italy, banned the practice.
Yeah.
They just ban it. They say, look, we're not going to be a party to this. We're, you know, people are hugely sympathetic to people who are infertile for very good reasons, because it's a terribly painful to be place to be. But is there a limit on things you can do, you know, in order to... I think there should be.
It does beg the question, you know, what's wrong with our joint committee that they haven't seen these and they haven't checked them out and they haven't looked at the...
I thought these are very established kind of, you know, politicians, a lot of them, but I thought there was a certain naivety in that they didn't seem to be aware of the controversies. Like, for example, there was a massive controversy in New York recently. They wanted to bring in commercial surrogacy. And a coalition formed among feminists and among all sorts of people to actually oppose this. Even the famous Gloria Steinem, you know, of Ms. Magazine fame, you know, people of a certain age will remember her as a very famous feminist, was totally against this. And the committee seemed to be almost like in a bubble. They were listening to the people that were in front of them, but they weren't kind of, they weren't looking at the broader debate. And for example, I'll give you a good example of their bubble mentality. There's a woman called Kasia Ekus Ekman, and she wrote a book called Buying and Being Bought, which is a really strong argument against both prostitution and surrogacy. A very strong book. And it was one of the factors that influenced the Swedish government to ban surrogacy completely.
And that was the first feminist government you were talking about.
Yes, exactly, first feminist government.
Yeah.
And she offered to come to speak to the committee. And as far as I know, I don't think she even received a reply.
Gosh.
Now, that's somebody willing to travel from another country to say, look, here in Sweden, this is what we've decided, this is why we've decided it, this is maybe why you should think about following our example. But she wasn't heard.
And the Joint Committee didn't even reply to her.
As far as I know, now I'm open to being corrected and apologising if I'm wrong, but that's my understanding that she didn't.
That's really desperate.
I just feel that in other countries, like even in New York, they had this massive debate that was aired. You know, you're giving me a space to debate this, and I'm extremely grateful for that. But in Ireland, we don't seem to be capable of having grown-up debates where people take, you know, opposing views, and they're not vilified for having, they're not assuming that they're working out of bad faith or whatever.
That's true. Listen, Breida, it is absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for, you know, apprising us of this whole issue. And just, you know, again, you know, because of all the background and research that you've done on it, it gives us a much, much wider perspective on the issue. So Breida O'Brien, columnist with the Irish Times, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Okay, thanks a million. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.